I'll affirm what Brother Timothy said. It is hard. I was just telling someone when I got here today, sometimes I'll look at a verse I preached on and I think, what did I ever say about that verse? I don't even remember what it means. I suppose that's the Lord's way of bringing humility and dependence and a neediness on Him. Thank you again for blessing us to be here. We've enjoyed being with you and with Brother Timothy and his family. If you'll turn to the book of Malachi again this morning, we'll look at Malachi chapter 3 and verse 13. Malachi chapter 3, verse 13. Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet you say, what have we spoken so much against thee? You have said, it is vain to serve God. This is the sixth dispute we find in the book of Malachi. God makes a claim. Israel responds with shock and unbelief, and then God answers to expose the corruption in Israel. There are really three types of people you find in the book of Malachi. The first one we would call a forsaker. Find this person in verse 7. Even from the days of your fathers, you are gone away from my ordinances and have not kept them. So there are people among Israel that have gone away. They have forsaken God, the fountain of living waters. But in verse 14, we find the formalist. This is the person who is actually keeping the ordinances of God and walking mournfully before Him. Now, there's nothing in the context that suggests that these people were not doing so. They have the form of religion. These are the people that would have the priority pyramid just as it should be. You remember that priority? First you have God, then you have marriage, then you have family, then you have church, then you have work, then you have community. Perhaps you work through such a pyramid, such a structure. These are the people that would be doing that very thing. They are indeed walking according to the ordinances of God, and they're walking mournfully, but they have the form. Then there are the fearers in verse 16. Then they that feared the Lord. My question to you this morning is, which one are you? You're one of the three. I'm going to assume you're not the forsakers because you're here. That only leaves two options. Either you're a formalist or you're a God-fearer. So my outline this morning first starts with stout words. Then we'll look at words of interest to God, and then we'll look at words of comfort from God. Stout words. Your words are stout against me, saith the Lord. Stout means rigid, severe, harsh. And of course, God gives them the answer to what stout words are. It's vain to serve God. The word vain means empty, without purpose, without any results. It's like a dead-end street. Have you ever had an occasion where someone gave you directions and you went and did exactly as they said and you turned right and you turned left and you went around those crazy circle roundabouts now and you kept going north and you took another right and you were at a dead end? It got you nowhere. No results. In other words, it's just not worth it. The formalist is living life by form or formula. And they approach God on the basis of a formula. Now, this is how the algebraic formula would go in Israel. First, you start with G, which is God. You got to start with God if you want to be blessed, right? Everybody knows that. You start with God. So G times parenthesis K, keeping ordinances. Because that's what they said. It's vain to serve God. What profit is it that we have kept His ordinances? There's the K. And walked mournfully before Him. So G times parenthesis K plus M for mourning equals what? P, profit. But there was no profit. So they're holding their hands up. Where's the profit? Where's the gain of serving God? Now, Paul was telling Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that inside the church of Jesus Christ in his day, we can assume in our day, there would be people living according to form looking for profit. He's not talking about outside the church in 2 Timothy 3. He's talking about inside of it. He said, in the last days, perilous times shall come. People shall be lovers of themselves. And he goes through a whole litany of sins. And then he says, lovers of pleasures more or rather than lovers of God. Having, the participle having tells us, this is what it means to love pleasures rather than God. Having the form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. This is why Paul told Timothy to preach the word the instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, and exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, where in churches, not outside them, but inside them, but will, after their own lusts, desires, heap to themselves, accumulate to themselves teachers having itching ears and turn away their ears from the truth unto fables. Have you ever had an itch so bad on your back that you couldn't stop until you got wife, husband, child, somebody to scratch it? And you go, ooh, ah, ah. It was so satisfying. Paul said, there'll be people that won't endure sound doctrine, so stay with sound doctrine. Now, that's not what I would have thought he would say. Timothy, if people won't hear what you say, change it up, man. Give them something else, not the word. They won't hear it. No. Preach the word because people won't listen to the word. So stay with it. And there'll be a departure. So the form of godliness is when people love pleasure, but they don't love the pleasures of God. That's not their profit. But they've got church, or God, marriage, family, church. They've got the pyramid in order. And they're keeping ordinances. It is vain to serve God. See, they assume that God is a formalist. That God is just someone you serve, and you do what He says, and you come to church like you're here today, and you expect then that marriage is going to go well, life is going to go well, kids are going to be obedient, work is going to go well, because you've plugged in the formula. You've got G times K plus M equal blessing and profit. Now, have you ever been guilty of doing that? I'll say I have. Now, look at verse 15. Here's what they're saying now, because the formula is not working. They're not getting the right answer from God. And now we call the proud happy. Now, there's a play on words here with the first statement and the third statement. Let me point it out. Verse 12, and all nations shall call you blessed or happy. We call the proud happy. Those are the same Hebrew words. God says, bring the tithe into the storehouse, return unto me, bring meat into my house, prove me therewith, and everybody's going to call you happy or blessed. No, no, we call the proud happy. Why? Because the formula is not working. I didn't get the promotion. I went to church. I even go to the Wednesday night Bible study. And I got demoted. We call the proud happy. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Now, when I was a young man, I knew what that meant. We would look at some young guy, he'd be driving a brand new Camaro or whatever the car was. I think it was Camaro in my day. Mustang. Man, he is set. He's got it made in the shade. Now that betrays two things. First of all, they think wicked people are set. And what are they saying? We thought we would be set with the formula. And we're not set. Have you ever thought that way? Isn't it vain to serve God? Isn't it just not worth it? I mean, you try, and what happens? Pain, sorrow, inflation, demotion. It's those wicked people that are set up. All right, here's the next play on words. They that tempt God are even delivered. Verse 10. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house, and prove, test, same Hebrew word as the word tempt. You say, test you, Lord, and you'll bless us. We say, the wicked test you every day. And what do? You deliver them. Now, there's some truth to that, beloved. Who on the planet gets delivered and God didn't do it by His providence? Can you name one? The most wicked of the wicked, when they are delivered, the providence of God delivered them. Would you agree? I hope so. That's Bible. So in some sense, He is delivering them. It's vain to serve God. Now, let me tell you the danger of these stout words. The danger is in the phrase, now we. There is a resolution, a transition, and a turning point that is saying, we will no longer serve God. That's the danger. The danger is apostasy and a departure from the living God. Because life is not going as you thought it would bring to you as a Christian. And you're disappointed. And you're discouraged. And you're dispirited. And you're disheartened. Why? Formula not working. And maybe you've at times come to the point, now we're not doing this church thing anymore. See, the reality with Israel, though, they weren't making a departure. They were already serving God out of a wrong kind of heart. This transition was not a realization they'd come to. They were already serving God in a way that their heart had already departed from the living God. You see, the God of greatest gain is the God we're going to serve, isn't it? And if God's not giving me the gain I want, and they use the word profit, if service to God does not bring me the profit I'm after, whatever that profit is for you, it may not be money for you, maybe something else. If serving God doesn't bring me the kind of spouse I want and the marriage I want, then I've had it with God. You could fill in that blank. So Israel, as far as their heart, had already departed from God, even though they were still in the forms of religion. And Jesus made that so clear. The God that we serve is the God of the greatest profit. We're wired that way. Jesus said in Matthew 6:24, no man can serve two masters. Serving a master is serving a God. He will either love the one and despise the other, love the one and hate the other, hold to the one, despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon or money or wealth. He didn't say you cannot have wealth. It's bad to have wealth. What are you doing with money? You can't serve money and serve God. Now, I could ask some young people here today, what do you think it means to serve money? If you were going to serve money, what would you do? They'd say, I guess I would get as much as I could. That's right. Now, why would you get as much as you could? I guess I would try to use it to make myself happy. That's right. That's how you serve money. We all know that. That's why somebody along the way made the statement, money can't make you happy. Well, why did you have to say that? Because that's what we think it'll do. Makes sense, right? Well, then how do you serve God? Do you get as much of God as you can? And your expectation that God is going to deliver on your desire for what? Happiness. My mother never had to sit me down as a young man and say, listen, Mike, I know you don't want to do this, but you really need to try to be happy. Since I was conceived and didn't even know it, my nature is to do everything solely for my happiness. To the food I eat, to the car I drive, to the house I'm in, if I can afford it, I'm going to get the house of greatest pleasure. And you are too. You're wired that way. You can't help it. You can't help it. So we serve the God of greatest profit. Now, if you just check your own life, you'll see you've kind of moved in that direction. In terms of trying to live life to bring you some peace, contentment, and joy. Paul would say this about his life before conversion when he talked to Titus in Titus chapter 3. He says, Titus, you know how it was with us. We were sometime, once upon a time, foolish, deceived, disobedient. We were in the darkness with regard to God. Now here's a participle. Remember, a participle tells us he's going to shed light in what that condition was like. The experience of foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving. What's the problem here? It's vain to serve God, serving all kinds of lust and pleasures. Now, when I see statements like that, the first thing I do in Bible study is say, what on earth does that mean? How do you serve a lust? How do you serve a pleasure? How do you serve a desire? You go find an object, whatever it is, a created object, and you try to get that object to meet the desire and bring you the satisfaction and the pleasure you're looking for. Paul said it was just all kinds. Now, the chief God he served was the God of man's glory in his religion. He was better than anyone. He profited above many his equals in his own religion. Why? Because the profit and the gain of the God he served was to be said, Paul, you are so good. You're such a wonderful Pharisee. And he loved it. Now, what happens when you serve lust and pleasure? Here's the next participle. Hateful and hating one another. You know why? When someone gets in the way of your God, you've got to get them out of the way. If it's your wife or your husband, that's why you're... James tells us, where do wars and fightings come from? Your own lust. Serving the wrong God. Somebody gets in the way of your God. Yeah, I mean, you can just see it. People driving. Somebody told me Memphis driving is crazy. I said, it's no worse anywhere else. Yes, it is. It's bad. I thought, you know, how could they squeeze in front of me that many times? You know? So, when we try to serve God according to form, we're going to be disappointed. We're going to find ourselves formalists because what we're doing, we've got the form, the religion plugged into this formula. And it means we're trying to use God for the profit. See? Now look at the contrast. Look at words of interest. Verse 16, then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. Now this is the contrast. So words of great interest to God. He didn't just hear it, he hearkened. Why did he say that twice? Why did he write a book of remembrance? And what were they saying to one another? And why were they saying it? I'll try to answer a few of those. To hearken and hear means not only to listen, but it means you've got my interest. God says, these people have piqued my interest. It's like he's bending over to hear what they're saying. You know, your words can pique God's interest. He hearkened, he heard it. He wrote a book of remembrance. Does God need to write a book of remembrance? No. He's telling us on terms that we can understand his interest to such that he wrote it in a book, probably more like a diary planner together. If you keep a diary, you want to record events that happen. Amazing. My wife can tell me every sermon I've preached and some of the notes for years. Just go back. What did I preach on that day? Here it is. She can tell me if I'm preaching the same thing again here. I hope I'm not, but I didn't consult her before today. So it's a diary he's going to remember, but it's also a planner. When you plan events, you're going to take action. So God is using words to tell us he is so interested in what they're saying, he is going to remember and he's going to take action. Because he loves what is being said. It's written before him, not so much in his presence, but in front of him here. And it's for them, it's on behalf of them that fear the Lord. What are they saying? Well, obviously, they're talking about God. Look at the parallelism. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another. Then they that feared the Lord thought on his name. That's not accidental. They were speaking about the name of God that came up into the nostrils of God as pleasure. That sounds kind of egotistical. Did I say that right? If you have an ego, you have an inflated sense of self-esteem and self-importance. Is anything more important than God? Can God esteem himself too much and say, well, I'm thinking too highly of myself? He is supreme. He is perfect and righteous and lovely and glorious. It is right for God to esteem God. And therefore, he hears when you talk to each other about him and he remembers it. He enjoys it. He loves it because there's nothing beside God, Isaiah 40. Whom you will compare me to, God says. Just look around. Find something to compare me to. There is nothing like me, God says. He's the incomparable sovereign. Would you agree with that? He is. Now, what exactly are they saying? they are saying about the name of God. What are they saying about the name of God? They're saying God is game. Now, how do I know that? Three reasons. If they weren't, it wouldn't please God. Now you say, well, that's kind of a weak one. Okay. Look at the contrast. It is vain to serve God. Then they that fear God were saying what? It is not vain. God is worthy. God is profit. God is gain. Right? And finally, perhaps the greatest evidence is that this word thought could be translated. That doesn't mean it was wrong to translate it this way. Could be translated esteem. They were esteeming God as great gain. And God said, I'm going to write that down. I'm going to remember that because it's right, it's holy, it's good, and God finds pleasure in His own gain because there's no greater gain than God. Now, isn't that what Paul told Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 6? There were false teachers, men of perverse minds, destitute of the truth, supposing that gain is godliness, supposing that godliness is the means to gain. What were they doing? G times K plus M equals gain. So you just use godliness to get the gain you want from God. Withdraw yourself from that prosperity gospel. But godliness with contentment is what? Great gain. For it is certain, we brought nothing into the world, we'll take nothing out. Therefore, having food and raiment, therewith be content. Could you be content with that, young people? You didn't get that dress you wanted or that suit you wanted or? Well, that won't work for you, young guys. That car you want? Man, if you could never got another promotion the rest of your life, ever, could you be satisfied with that? In godliness you can, because if you only have godliness, you have God. He is the gain. Now, I'm not going to deny to you that there is not other gain that God gives us. I mean, my wife is a great gain to me. Food is gain. My house, God grants us with so much blessing. But He must be the object of the greatest gain, or we're idolaters. We're serving a desire and a pleasure, Paul would say. So what they were saying was they're thinking on the name of God. They're speaking about the name of God. They're saying it's not vain to serve God. It is profit to serve God because God is great gain. And that's what we need to be, isn't it, beloved? I'm not always there. Are you? Sometimes I'm a formalist. Sometimes I get confused with the formula and think, God, you know, you come to God and pray. So, well, God, I did that. Why didn't it bring that? Okay. God is good. He's gracious. He's merciful. But God must be the greatest treasure. And then finally, listen to God's words of comfort. Verse 17. And they shall be mine, the fearers. Shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, special treasure. Now, I wouldn't think God would use that language for you and me, but He does. You're His possession, His special treasure. Why? Because you're connected to His name, which is treasure. He didn't say, I'll manufacture my jewels. I'll gather them up. And I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Now, first of all, the reason God can be just in sparing you is because Romans 8:32 says He didn't spare His own son. Isn't that good news? The only way God can be just in sparing you, the only way is if He didn't spare the righteous Son of God. And He didn't. He spared not His own son, but delivered Him up for you all. How will He not then freely give us all things? That you need to serve Him is the implication. So He didn't spare Jesus, therefore He can spare you. You're His jewel. If you trust Jesus Christ as your Savior, if you have come to Christ by faith, then you are God's unique possession. You belong to God. Now, He's not saying they will be mine. The implication is they are now and they will be then. Because He says in verse 18, then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and the formulas that doesn't, which is the implication, right? So it's not in one day they'll become jewels and be His. They already are. But one day you will see and be able to discern the difference between the righteous and the wicked, those that serve God and those that don't. Those that serve God like a slave, vain to serve God, and those that serve God like a son to a father. And I want to end on that note. See, the difference in the service between the God-fearer and the formalist is slavery to a master, distant. You know, we just want the master to give us what we want. Now, we don't want to relate to him. We don't want anything to do with him. He's just like my boss at work. I mean, yeah, he's an okay guy. I don't want to go to dinner with him. I certainly don't want to go to the game with him on Saturday. I just want him to give me a paycheck. That's slavery. How does a son serve a father? Well, it's the difference in the two prodigals in Luke 15. The one goes out and riotous living, but when he comes home, he says, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of the slaves in the house. Make me as a hired servant. So when he comes back, the father sees him afar off, runs and embraces him, lets the son confess because he needs to. He says, I have sinned against heaven in thy sight, and I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Boom, boom, boom. Puts his hand over his mouth. Why? There will be no slaves in the father's house. You're a son. You've been bought. You come into the house. Now, what's a son doing in the house? Now, there's some collateral stuff going on. He gets education. He gets some money now. He was broke. He gets the house. But he has the father. He's back with the father. The gain is the father. It's him. The slaves don't relate to the father. Now, the older brother is outside. And he's mad when he hears all the ruckus about the party. He's a slave. He says, I have worked for you. I've worked for you all my life. I've been plugging in formulas all my life. I thought G times K plus M equals kid or goat. And you never gave me the goat I want. I've been working, serving, formulating with you, and you don't give me the goat. Why do you want the goat? I just want to go make merry with my friends. I don't care anything about you, Dad. I just want my friends to see how great I am, how good I am, how moral I am, and make much of me. He's a slave in the Father's house. The son that serves the Father serves Him out of love. He loves the Father. He wants to be with the Father. And all that the Father gives him, a good house to live in, food on the table, shoes on his feet, a roof over his head, is just add-on because God is the prophet. Who are you serving, beloved? Are you serving God for a kind of prophet? That we use God like a formula, or is God your greatest treasure? May God bless you.